Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'm joined here today with Judge Jerome Tao to my left and Judge Abby Silver to my right. We also are video recording this proceeding, unless we hear an objection. These are normally audio recorded, so the arguments are saved for posterity and for our use and deliberation on a case. We decided to video to increase our knowledge about the case. It's better to look than just and listen rather than just listen. Plus, we might use it for other educational purposes. So, just so you're aware of it. All right, the next matter on our docket is case number 65419, Tom versus Innovative Home Systems, LLC. And we have Mr. Pizzillo. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Okay. And do you have a co-counsel today, too? Okay. Good afternoon to you, too, Ms. Lloyd. And then Mr. Mead, too?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Do either one of you have your clients here today?
We do not.
Okay.
All right. All right. We'll proceed then. Mr. Pizzillo, you're first, of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Brian Pizzillo, along with Jennifer Lloyd, for the appellant, Dr. Timothy Tom, in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is factually is relatively straightforward and arises from the granting of a motion for summary judgment in the district court. The procedural posture at the time that the motion was granted was a complaint had been initiated by IHS, an answer filed by our client, along with a counterclaim. No reply had been filed by IHS at that time. No joint case conference report had been prepared. Discovery had not yet commenced. The motion for summary judgment that was granted in this matter represented the second time that substantially the same motion had been heard. Initially, a motion for summary judgment had been filed by IHS and had been heard by Senior Judge Brennan. After hearing the issue at oral argument and reviewing the pleadings and having taken it under advisement, he found there were issues of fact that precluded the granting of summary judgment. Subsequently, the motion was refiled. It had been denied without prejudice. The only material change in the second motion was the fact that it included certain opinions from the Nevada State Contractors Board. Ultimately, the court granted that motion, and it did so, and we believe for error, and we would submit it was error, on two general grounds. One was the application of what amounts to a preclusive doctrine to the actions or inactions of the Nevada State Contractors Board, specifically an individual investigator employed by the board. And two, a misapplication of the Rule 56 standards. Addressing the Contractors Board matter initially, it's acknowledged that in the proper circumstances, you can have administrative issue preclusion, claim preclusion. Those do apply. Now, as we've set forth, I think, in detail in our opening brief, the standards were not met for either of those, and that has not been contested in this matter. In fact, what happened in this case was inaction by the Nevada State Contractors Board, and that the board itself never undertook any action. It was the actions of an individual investigator who took action in regards to a consumer complaint that our client, Dr. Tom, had filed in March of 2013. The board itself never undertook any action in terms of hearings, evidence gathering, presentation of witnesses, cross-examinations. No final order, judgment, decree, or otherwise was ever issued by the board. The only thing that occurred was at the consumer complaint being filed, the investigator then meeting with Dr. Tom and the parties, and the investigator then validating 9 items that Dr. Tom had complained about and, in fact, required IHS to then return to the residence owned by him here in Las Vegas and correct those 9 items because he found that they were not adequately performed.
So let's
I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry. Did he give any opinion about whether a license was needed?
No.
Okay, go ahead, Judge Town.
I was going to say, so let's put that aside for a second. Let's say that, you know, the board's in action. Let's say we can't take any, make any legal inference from that because boards, you know, they don't have the investigative resources that, for example, a district attorney might not. So let's say we don't put any weight into what the board did or didn't do. What else in this case is disputed then?
There are 2 primary groups of items that would be disputed. One is identified in Dr. Tom's affidavit. There are 7 specific items that he outlined that he said that even after IHS returned to his residence and performed the additional work as required by the investigator, that still did not function pursuant to the contract. And he broke down those seven specific items in his affidavit as not functioning. And that included programming that wasn't complete, a rack ventilation that was not functioning, an overheat issue in the theater in his residence, sprinkler systems not functioning, window switchable smart tint, the fancy windows that if you flip the switch they go opaque, not functioning, warranty coverage not being issued, and a lack of a wiring diagram for items upstairs. And so he found, his opinion is that pursuant to the agreement between IHS and himself, those items still remain even after the contractor's board. The second main issue is the issue of licensure. Was IHS required to be licensed at the time that it entered into the agreement with Dr. Tom and bid the agreement? And that is the pertinent time period that you look at under 624.700. You must look at whether or not the contractor was licensed at that time. It's not disputed in terms of the timeline in this matter that the pertinent agreement was entered into in April of 2012 between IHS and Dr. Tom. The consumer complaint was filed in March of 2013. And between those two dates in September 25th, 2012 to be exact, IHS did acquire a contractor's license.
Right, but if you don't have a license, it doesn't matter if the work you're doing doesn't fall within the scope of the type of work that requires a license. And some of this stuff, you're talking about, you know, installation of wireless systems, that kind of thing. Well, you know, laymen can do that. Why do you need a license to do that? And who decides whether a particular kind of work does or does not fall within the scope of what you need a license to do?
Answering what I interpret to be two different questions,
it is.
C2D is a low-voltage license as prescribed by the Nevada State Contractors Board. And at some point, whether or not somebody is required to have a license could be decided in one of two different forms. If the board were to take action, certainly they have the power to make that determination.
But they didn't.
And they didn't.
Right.
Then it would fall to the district court to then take evidence to determine what work was done and does that fall under the C2D requirement.
The district court failed to do so in this case.
Correct. And in this case, they applied the preclusive effect, and in fact, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, expressly stated, this must necessarily have been decided in the Nevada State Contractors Board's closing of the complaint. However, as is undisputed, it was ignored. And that's not undisputed. It's in fact, page 16 of the respondent's brief, it admits it was ignored. Therefore, there wasn't evidence taken on that. There is IHS's opinion, there's our client's opinion. Therefore, that would render it, you know, inapplicable for a motion for summary judgment.
Right, but, you know, we still have to affirm if the result is correct, even though the district court's reasoning is wrong. So let's say the district court erred. Let's even assume for a second the district court erred in saying that, okay, because the board didn't do anything, there's preclusive effect. Okay, let's put that aside. So what else? What else about the district court's order is wrong? What are the conclusions, aside from the preclusive effect, that are wrong that she shouldn't have granted summary judgment on?
Well, certain items that were identified by Dr. Tom, for instance, if you look at its revision 9.1, which is identified as the final agreement between the parties, it calls for items specifically that are covered by a C2D license, such as irrigation. That's in the contract. It's in the administrative code as promulgated by the contractor's board. These seven items were there. And additionally, we have to make kind of a distinguishing line between what the board decides and what the court decides. The Nevada Supreme Court stated quite clearly in the case of Bivens versus Nevada State Contractors Board that the board applies the administrative code. However, it is error for the administrative agency to get into contract damages. And that's what happened in that case, and the Supreme Court reversed and cautioned the contractors board that it is not to award contract damages, it is not to invade that is within the unique province of the district court. That those damages can only be awarded by the district court. So even if the contractors board came forward and said, well, we think that the work that's done meets the minimum standards in the industry, and so we're satisfied, that doesn't mean it meets the contractual obligations as agreed to between the parties. And the only way to determine that is to take evidence from each party and afford each party an opportunity to present that evidence in a full and open manner, as opposed to a point where discovery has not even commenced. Therefore, that licensing issue it's kind of twofold, and it's a threshold issue, but then even if you don't have to require the license, was the contract work performed? And that issue, in this case, was not evaluated by the district court. Again, the district court relied upon essentially a preclusive type doctrine from the contractors board, and in that regard, specifically, advisory opinions that the board had issued in unrelated matters that, frankly, in bold language, state right on there, this is to be applied solely to these specific facts and circumstances.
And applied it to your case.
I'm sorry.
And applied it to this case.
And applied it to this case. And in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the district court actually stated, I recognize that that language is in there, but I find it persuasive anyway, and I'm going to apply it. Well, the reason we don't do that is, and the contractors board told us, actually in those opinions, and stated, oftentimes those opinions are issued on incomplete facts. Change one fact, you may change an entire opinion. So we don't really know what was presented to the board. We don't know why they decided the way that they did. And to kind of blindly apply that without hearing additional facts would be an error.
What about the attorney's fees issues, too? You want to reserve time for a reply, so we want to make sure we have all the issues out there so you can talk about those if needed. It seems like either side might complain about the attorney's fees in this case because the judge reduced them, but they were still very significant.
They were.
Is the complaint regarding the failure to apply the Brunzell factors, or is it because matters that happened at the administrative level were added into what was done in the district court and all those fees were put together?
Both. The Brunzell was not analyzed whatsoever in the order. And additionally, as put forth on the record, we've identified approximately $15,000 that was applicable to actions that took place before the contractor's board. The Chapter 108, which governs mechanics liens, specifically states that those are to be applied to actions in the district court in prosecuting your mechanics lien, not defending a board action, which, frankly, the investigator found in favor of Dr. Tom and required additional work to be performed. So I think it's both, that there were issues in both cases.
Well, if there had been full board hearings like you talked about at the beginning, that didn't happen. But if those had happened and those findings were applied in the district court, would those fees then be permissible?
If a full board hearing took place, my answer would be no, because the parties to that proceeding are the contractor's board and the licensee. Our client is not actually, once they file a consumer complaint, that ends our client's involvement. The real parties become the contractor and the board governing the contractor. At that point in time, my client would not have, they're not entitled to the right to present any evidence. Or,
all right, so your position is no fees can be awarded for actions that happened at the administrative level?
Correct. That is correct. And we relied obviously upon Barney, the Supreme Court case for that proposition. In that it was very specific that it said a district court action, which is where mechanics liens, of course, are prosecuted and commenced.
Do you want to reserve your final 4 minutes?
I'd be happy to reserve those few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Pizzillo. All right, Mr. Mead, we'll switch to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's one minute. I'm technologically challenged in that I have a bunch of it and rely on it in these proceedings.
What do you have?
I use the record on my iPad and am able to get to it and have my argument on my computer. So, first of all, thank you for allowing me to appear before you. I've appeared before Judge Tao and Judge Silver before, but not before you. I've appeared before Justice Gibbons a number of times, but appreciate the opportunity to do so. This is an interesting case. This is a case that, in my view, started off as a very simple matter that should have been resolved and never should have gone to this this point whatsoever. Unfortunately, I believe that in order to try to take an advantage of certain systems, try to get a discount, we ended up here. And my client is, sort of the not going to put in for that. He's going to deal with what he's got to do and pay attorney's fees to the extent he needs to, and the other side apparently is going to too, so here we are.
Having been a settlement judge for a long time, it does make one wonder.
Yeah, it does.
but we're here, so.
But just very briefly, mentioned that there was no JCCR file. I want to make sure it's understood because the record wasn't complete. There was actually an ECC handled, or the case conference handled, in November. My client provided its disclosures that same day on November 20th. No disclosures were ever provided by Mr. Tom. And we prepared a JCCR. It was never finalized. So it was proceeding down that path. Nevertheless, it's true. There were an initial filing that was heard by Judge Brennan. Quite frankly, I think it's a stretch to say that he made any orders in that. What he ended up doing, he made some statements from the bench that he didn't think he had enough information, and then he'd let us know what happened, and all he did was deny it without prejudice. I mean, it was He didn't make any orders whatsoever. We put in the orders to show that. So not really sure what the point of that is, but there was no finding that discovery needed to happen or anything else. He just denied it. There's an assignment of two errors. And first of all, the preclusive effect applied by the board's non-determination. I'm not sure we can get there. First of all, that issue was never raised at the court below. But even leaving that aside, the issue is not one of preclusive effect. The issue is one of who has the burden of proof. My client has done business since 2005, and the record was very clear that he felt he did not need a license, that he fell within an exception to that license. And he testified in his affidavit that the only reason he got a license in September was to do other work that would have required new construction work. It would have required him to run wires and other things to put it into. It was also very clearly laid out in that affidavit, and again, not disputed, that these materials bolt into existing systems. You take out a switch, you put in a new one. You're not running new wires. You're not running new systems to go through. And then you take that, you know, plug in a machine and program it, and it wirelessly controls your house. And the precursor of Dave, I think, from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Walk in, hello, how are you? And turn on everything for you. That's what it was supposed to do. My client says they don't need a license. The burden shifts at that point, I believe, to Dr. Tom to say, yeah, you do, and here's why. The problem is other than just saying a C2D license covers some of these items, and therefore you need it, he provided no evidence whatsoever to the court that a license was needed. None. My client was in a position to try to say, wait a minute, I've got to prove a negative that I don't need a license?
Well, why does the burden shift? What if Dr. Tom said, yes, you need a license, if he'd said it first? Actually, he did file a lawsuit. Would that put the burden on the contractor to say, no, I don't? I mean, where does burden shifting come from? What's the source of authority for that?
Well, it's a defense. To say that he needed a license and doesn't have it is a defense. And that burden is, to prove a defense, you have the burden of proof, the one asserting the defense.
Are you talking about the contract claim or the mechanics lien?
Both. Because the argument is that I needed a license, or not needed. My client needed a license in order to both have a contract and have a mechanics lien. Now, that's true. That's what the statute says. If a license is required, the lien claimant or the plaintiff has to plead and prove that he's got one.
So the question,
you can even tell by looking at the contract. In this case, I mean, somebody that's not that doesn't have that kind of knowledge of C2K, whatever it is, perhaps somebody like myself, you can't look at that contract and know whether or not, without taking evidence, whether or not you need that type of license.
Well, I'm not sure it's a matter of that. It's a matter of having to actually know and what the work is that's going on there. Now, again, the uncontradicted evidence in this case from Mr. Brown, never disputed by Mr. Tom in his affidavit, is that Brown went and told Tom, I can't do licensed work. I'm not going to do that. If you've got to hire someone else to do it, I can connect my systems to that. But I can't put in licensed work. And again, uncontradicted, Tom hired Meridian Construction and Kent's Glass, who are licensed contractors, to perform that work. Very clear.
So the ultimate question, normally the board decides what type of work needs a contractor's license and what type of work doesn't need licensing. If the board didn't do anything, which they didn't in this case, then the question of whether a particular kind of work requires a license, is that one of law or one of fact?
Well, I think it's one of law.
Okay, so here's my question. If it's a question of law, then why is there any burden?
Why is there any burden?
Your burden normally relates to evidence. You have the burden on questions of fact. Questions of law are just questions of law. Nobody's got the burden at all. So why is there any burden shifting?
Well, here's the reason. Okay, well, first of all, let me back up. I don't think the court even has the ability to decide whether or not something is licensed or not, okay? Whether or not work falls into a license or not. That's something exclusively to the contractors board.
Well,
specifically,
the district court judge did. That's how the summary judgment got granted.
No. She looked at the situation and said, the board has done nothing, in a sense, but they, by doing nothing, they have had the opportunity. They were obligated under the statutes to do something if it was unlicensed, and they didn't. There's all these other things. You know, we got these administrative determinations. They're persuasive. They're not final determination, but they're persuasive. What she said was, Tom has provided no evidence whatsoever to say that a license is needed. The closest they got was the assertion by counsel that, he says he did some patching work on the drywall but doesn't do it. Well, why? Because he did wiring, okay? That has to be there. Well, no. Have you ever taken the switch plate off of one of your house and had the paint peel because somebody put it on before the paint was dry? Happens all the time. That's not wiring. That's patching. Okay? It's incidental. But, the Supreme Court just last week, maybe two weeks ago, came out with a case called James S. Tate versus the State of Nevada Board of Medical Examiners. It's 131 Nevada Advance Opinion 67. And in page 4, Supreme Court said, it is well established that the courts have no inherent appellate jurisdiction over official acts of administrative agencies except where the legislature has made some statutory provision for judicial review. Citations. Moreover, the extent of the court's jurisdiction is controlled by the statute conferring that jurisdiction. There is no court review whatsoever in Chapter 624 over the establishment of the license classifications and what falls into them. None. And as a matter of fact, I was hunting around, I found that an attorney general's opinion.
So let me ask you this, it's a practical matter. If the district court doesn't have any power to determine whether particular work needs a license or not, so what you're saying then is this, anytime someone is doing work and they sue for non-payment of bills and the defendant then raises the defense of, oh, you didn't have a license, since the court doesn't have power to decide that issue, what happens? Does the case then freeze? Does it have to be dismissed? What exactly is the implication of that if the district court doesn't have the power to decide that issue?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure in the sense that, who's going to make the decision. I mean, contractors, the purpose of those statutes is to prevent unlicensed contracting, okay? Because in the state, they want to control the contractors. And as I mentioned, the attorney general opinion says that the legislature's preempted the licensing of contractors in enacting 624, that's Attorney General Opinion 208. But the point is you have to plead and prove that you had it. Now, if you're an unlicensed contractor doing framing, and you do not have a license, but you're out building houses, okay, and you come in and say, hey, I need a lien for this, or I need to get paid for that, of course, well, did you have a license? No, don't have a license, can't do it, okay? Well, it's pretty clear, if you're doing framing of a new structure, you need a license. That's not incidental to anything you're doing.
Ultimately, a court would have to decide it. Take the criminal case. Contractors board brings the action. Person needed a license, didn't have it. DA's office files it. It goes to trial. A judge is going to hear it and make a decision. Do you need a license or not? The contractors board doesn't have the final say. Or if it's a civil case and a petition for judicial review, a court's going to decide it, too. So ultimately, a court will be involved in this. The question is, in our case, should the court have made that decision early on in the proceedings like it did without having any real facts presented?
There were facts presented. But, because there was an affidavit that clearly laid out.
Disputed fact,
Where was it disputed? I mean, that's what I got to say. It's disputed by what? In order to dispute that fact, there has to be admissible evidence of material fact. There wasn't any.
Why should this court uphold the award of attorney's fees when the district court didn't analyze the fees in light of the Brunzell factors?
Well, the Brunzell factors were clearly argued to the court. And if the court didn't, make a determination and outline on the Brunzell, I think the appropriate thing is to send it back and have the court do that. It's not to just disallow attorney's fees, which is what Dr. Chom would like to do. I think also you can look at the Brunzell factors that have been gone through and looked at close, and axiomatic that the court went through and did it and actually made some determinations, lowered my fees in this case fairly substantially, which, yeah, I didn't like that. But, in the effort to not make this thing even worse than it's going to be, we decided not to further appeal it.
Why were the fees included for actions at the administrative level?
Because it's not just there. The action in filing the complaint to the administrative level had a very distinct purpose. It wasn't to fix problems. By the way, if you looked at that complaint, there were 52-plus items listed of what was problem. The contractor's board came back with 9, okay? Interestingly enough, the 9 of the 9, 7 of them, might be 6, were just programming issues. Reprogram this, reprogram that. That thing isn't working. You know, there was a pad that wasn't functioning when we went through the walkthrough. It turned out it was just not plugged in. The switch was off. There are lots of those kinds of things. But very interesting, item number 5 related to glass, the smart glass. And it says right in it, you're going to hook it up after others install it. Okay? After it's installed by others. Now, it's also important to note that, and I wanted to make sure this is heard, the reference to the irrigation in revision 9.1 as it's being listed. That is actually on the Joint Appendix 582. And if you look at it, there's no dollars. There's no dollars. There's no items. Okay? So it was taken out. Okay? It was still sitting there in terms of a category, but there's no dollars for it. And that was the point. He's not looking to recover money from this. It's not in it. And, just so we understand, on the glass issue, that was involved in the last change order. During the repair, Dr. Tom comes to him and says, hey, I want additional work done. They agree with the change order, and he signs off on it. So Exhibit 18, you can see Dr. Somp signs that he agrees to do the additional work, although he says, but this doesn't apply to everything else. So the fact that he then turns around and says that this work is not done is amazing to me. It just flat is. But that affidavit, how can that affidavit get through? It's just conclusions. He talks about after the contract. Well, there's at least 3 contracts out there that has already been shown. Meridian's contract, Ken's glass contract, and my client's contract. Which one's he talking about? And the racks? Well, they talk about, oh, yeah, there's racks or ventilation, and they point to an email that was written. If you read the email, he's talking about someone else who's supposed to do the work and says, he wanted me to apologize to you for not getting it done. It's not my client's work. For Mr. Tom to sit there and say that it is unbelievable. And there just wasn't any backup to that affidavit to make it admissible to this court. And that's what this court found. That's what the district court found, that it wasn't admissible. Let's see.
I don't know if the court used those words, though. I mean, that you, obviously a plaintiff can submit an affidavit to resist a summary judgment and try to raise factual issues and do the backup, which Dr. Tom did, and that is ask for discovery to occur before the court decides it. And the court didn't grant that request either.
Well, that's true. But look at that affidavit, okay? That affidavit says the license issue is the only thing. It doesn't talk about contract. It doesn't talk about what's due there. It talks about we're going to take contractor's board, the investigator's deposition. That's going to be pretty tough to do, to be honest, since it's all supposed to be confidential. Number 2, it says you might need an expert. Well, I'm sorry. The contractor board is the exclusive arbiter of what is licensing. You're not going to get an expert to come in and say one way or the other. But those are the only things they talked about. You didn't need an expert to talk about or discovery to talk about whether or not things were done or whether there was any problem getting the discovery. They didn't do any. And what's really amazing is, yeah, we filed an initial summary judgment motion in October, and this one comes a few months later, the same affidavit. He didn't bother to address the issues that were clearly laid out in the first summary judgment motion. They didn't take a little time to do it. That contractor's board claimed the reason it should be included is because it was in bad faith. That was not about getting this thing done. There was no statement by IHS that they would never do any more work, that they wouldn't perform the stuff, and they wouldn't fix the issues. They said they would. They wanted to get an interim payment, undisputed.
All right. Mr. Mead, I think that's...
I'm past my time, as I will often do. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Pizzillo, you had reserved 4 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Let me address a couple of issues. One was Your Honor's question about burden shifting. Is it a question of law? Is it a question of fact? It's both. It's a mixed question, as most things are. You have to apply the law to the facts. We know what the law will say in a C2D license, but then the question is what facts do we apply that to and did those facts take place? Therefore, fact investigation must take place. With regard to another item that I heard that was just stated that there's nothing in the record that indicated that IHS had ever indicated it had a license or anything else. Well, the joint appendix, which was agreed to by all parties, contains an email from Jeffrey K. Brown, the president, that says, and this was in response to an email from Dr. Tom, I can assure you, I have all licenses, insurances, and federal and state IDs necessary to perform my scope of work since October 05. Furthermore, the contractors I work with are fully licensed, bonded, and insured. So that when IHS makes that assertion, they're only relying on their own affidavit, not the entirety of the evidence submitted.
What page is that?
That was Joint Appendix page 33.
Is there any argument that because they are getting the other contractors or subs that they are acting as some kind of general here?
They very well could be, and that's something that I think would have to be borne out. I mean, these items appeared in revision 9.1, which is the pertinent document identified by IHS as being the final agreement between the parties. So if you have a line item there, regardless of whether there's a dollar amount or not, you're essentially bidding it, which would imply you have to be licensed. And whether you're acting as a general contractor, a construction manager, at some point titles don't become important, but it's the substance of what are you actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we never reached that point in the district court. I mean, it's beyond dispute. There's no discovery took place whatsoever. One of the comments that I heard made was that the board actions are supposed to be confidential. Well, how are they then given preclusive effect, and why did the district court then rely on them if this is a confidential proceeding? Which, in some instances, you could consider that. It's a dispute resolution process, if you want to, for lack of a better term, where you have an informal meeting with an investigator, the contractor, and the party filing a consumer complaint, and you try to work things out. It works sometimes, and sometimes not as much. In this case, I think it had mediocre success. With regard to burden shifting, I would respectfully direct the court's attention to 624.320. That says that with regard to contractors collecting for money, it says in order to collect compensation, you have to do so, you're not permitted to do so without alleging and proving that such person, firm, co-partnership, corporation, association, or other organization was duly licensed contractor at all times during the performance of the contract and when the job was bid. So the law clearly is placing a burden. With regard to, I heard a lot, well, evidence wasn't presented, discrete, I guess, very specific evidence. We have to remember where we're at. We're talking about a physician. He's not a contractor. He doesn't know what goes on behind a wall. It's undisputed IHS has stated, there were, in fact, penetrations in the wall. Was that pulling the playoff? I don't know. That's not what it says. So if there's penetrations, if there's drywall patching, if there's painting, well, what's going on? Why are you behind that wall? We don't know, and any homeowner, it's unreasonable to think that they're going to know off the top of their head what's going on. That's why you hire an expert. That's why you hire somebody you think knows what they're doing in contracting. That's why people would go to him as a physician. You don't go to a contractor for surgery, you go to a doctor. Well, that's what he did, and he has the right to rely upon that expertise. He identified 7 items that were still not functional. That's all he could do at that point. The why are they not functional is something that has to be fleshed out in discovery because nobody knows at that point. The defense of, well, it's not within our scope, I understand that. And that's a defense, and they're perfectly entitled to raise it, but it's a question of fact that the court should have allowed discovery upon. At the end of the day, and actually I have 1 second left, so I'll stop there. And on those, we request that you reverse remand.
You can make your concluding comment.
Based upon the fact that you've heard, we do request that this matter be reversed and remanded in total so that it may proceed forward on the merits, allow for discovery. With regard to the attorney's fees, the only comment I wanted to make there was there's a comment that the board's action was bad faith. That's a fact determination that has not been made. And nevertheless, it's still outside the purview of the district court. And the final comment I was going to make is that with regard to the contractor's board having exclusive jurisdiction, district courts every single day make the determination as to whether a mechanics lien claimant is licensed or not. They have to. Otherwise, in answer to your question, Your Honor, every mechanics lien action is going to have to be stayed so that it can be referred to the board and hope the board takes it. There's nothing that says the board's got to issue an opinion. And that's not the law. It never has been. And that would bring litigation. I can't even imagine how much that would boggle the courts down. So thank you for your time today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fizeau and Mr. Meek. Good job by both counsel. This matter will be submitted to the court for a decision at a later time.